And that was activist Steve Plaich, who I actually introduced, but the sound was too low for you to hear me out there. We're, of course, talking on a Saturday, but you're hearing this on a Sunday, the 3rd of February. So, yeah, very few shelters are open, and also some sad news from the Warming Center and the, well, the Warming Center, which is kind of an overflow shelter for the 7th Avenue shelter that you heard Steve Plaich mention, which has to do with 50 spaces already reserved, only 60 total. It's what I call part of the winter shelter hoax, run by the well-funded but tight-fisted Susie O'Hara and Tina Scholl and the folks who are supposed to be managing homeless services through the Santa Cruz City Council. But have been lying about it, or let's say changing their stories frequently. And I am most unhappy with that. In fact, somewhat, you might even say, angry about that. But, well, here's Brent Adams talking about the Warming Shelter, and I can probably spare a little animus for that program, too, although it's probably a much better program and a much more open program than the other programs. But it's closed when it's not open, and it's not open almost all the time.
Center program, Santa Cruz and Watsonville, not open tonight. Saturday, Sunday, Monday, February 2nd, 3rd, and 4th. There is rain, but not enough to trigger our activation in time. Likely open in Watsonville on Tuesday and Wednesday, the 5th and 6th, due to a extreme temperature drop following rain. If you need shelter, please access the pre-existing shelters, winter shelters. For instance, in Santa Cruz, it's pre-registration on email, wintershelter santa cruz@gmail.com. Find a way to get that. Watsonville, 214 Union Street in Watsonville, Salvation Army. We encourage you to get on all the waiting lists at Homeless Services Center on Coral Street. Their number is 831-458-6020. If you need blankets or warm clothing, you're having any type of emergency, you need help, leave a message. Keep calling back. We'll try to get to you as soon as we can. If you're donating items, blankets, shoes, tents, tarps, warm clothing of any kind, thank you very much. Yes, we need them. We have barrels at Staff of Life, New Leaf on the west side, New Leaf on 41st Avenue. Thank you very much. If you're carrying weight, you need a place to store stuff, we've got you. Day and Night Storage Program. Open every day in the morning at 8 to 10 in the morning, 5 to 7 in the evening, 150 Felker Street, Suite H. From Ocean Street at Denny's, take Felker Street to the back. Ross, Dress for Less, footbridge over the levee. We're right there on the left, 150 Felker Street, Suite H. If you need Brent Adams, 588-9892. Now, spend the day trying to take care of yourself so you can be warm at night. Really important, so you can take care of those around you. And we'll see you soon at the Warming Center program.
So, as I mentioned to Steve Plaich, the HUF organization, Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom, has had its usual Wednesday midday meeting, actually kind of meeting in a joint session with Conscience and Action, which has been working with HUF and with city council members to try to put stuff on the city council agenda coming up for the second Tuesday in February, when this month. And that's going to take up a lot of meeting time, a lot of attention, perhaps too much meeting time and attention. But whenever there's a chance to see the bigwigs do something at the top, everybody gets all excited, and I'm no exception, unfortunately. I should have learned better by this time. But there's always this new hope when new council members have come in, particularly when one of them seems to be particularly active. I'm thinking of Drew Glover, who rounded up, I think he had four interns available at this meeting last Monday, almost a week ago, in which we sat down for 2 hours and really hammered out issues around four or five basic concerns. One of them was the Ross Camp and what to do with its now essentially bursting to overflowing, having inadequate sanitation services, inadequate cover for people, and inadequate drainage, needs more potable water and gray water, needs shower and laundry access, all kinds of obvious things. And this is the first time that this kind of consideration of resources has ever happened in Santa Cruz for this large a number of unhoused folks, other than, let's say, after the earthquake of 1989, when it was the previously housed folks who were earthquaked out of their homes that got some attention. I was around in those days doing the same kind of stuff I'm doing now, though I wasn't on the radio. And it's impressive that this is even being discussed, and more important, discussed with some homeless people. There were a couple of people who, one from the camp, Greg, and another from an RV who you may have read about in the Sentinel, and you may have heard on my radio show, Alicia Cool, who lives with her family in a van and has been challenging the police chief to get him and his Rangers and his cops, since he runs both, it seems, a large contingent of Rangers and cops, that's Chief Mills, to lay off of people in their vehicles, at least insofar as they're registered and they're legal and they're within the 70-tower limits, and not to respond without serious skepticism and significant warnings to residential folks who think that they somehow own the streets, the sidewalks, and the entire public spaces around their homes, and feel they have a right to drive away using the police department or private vigilante activity folks whose only home is their vehicle and who are parked on the public streets legally, not doing any dumping, not doing any harassing, not doing anything illegal, but just being there. That somehow is an affront to people in houses. And Mills, of course, has been backing this up, although he likes to play this neutral game where he's, you know, this great liberal police chief. But when he was asked if he would do something to stop the policies that involve police coming out prior to a 72-hour time period, when during which period of time you're supposed to be legal, parked in your vehicle, if it's legally situated, and running around looking for different kinds of violations at the behest of merchants, or I should say residents, not really merchants most times, though I guess it's happened with a couple times with merchants, who want to drive away homeless people because they don't want homeless people in their neighborhoods, for whatever reason, not because they have a particular criminal activity to really support. And I and others asked Mills, as did Alicia Cool, to advise people that it's a crime to make a false police report, and that the police have ways of seeing if a vehicle has been there for more than 72 hours. They apparently have a system, according to Chief Mills, a secret system, mind you, but still a system. So if they have such a system, then they can tell the calling party, get this vehicle away from our house, to say, well, you should be aware that if it's been there for 72 hours, we can certainly, we can ticket the vehicle, or we can, you know, urge the person to leave. But we have ways of knowing if it hasn't been there 72 hours, then you're making a false police report, and we can give you a ticket for doing that. It's a misdemeanor punishable by up to a year in jail, or maybe it's 6 months in jail. I'm not sure what the specific misdemeanor charge is on that, the fine for violating it. Plus, I think it's $1,000. But you'll hear Mills doing that, I suppose, when pigs fly, as they say. Or at least we didn't get any kind of assurance from him that he could do that. So the latest issue, however, has to do with, well, that was one of the issues discussed by this working group working together to put some items on the city council agenda, which supposedly has this four-person progressive majority, Crone, Brown, Cummins, and Glover, to actually pass some ordinances. They failed to pass a rent freeze, apparently running in terror, at least one of them, Cummins. That's not fair to say running in terror, but he certainly voted against an immediate action on the rent freeze, even though a lot of people who voted for him, and he won along with Glover, favored a rent freeze in Santa Cruz, and Santa Cruz has a majority of tenants, and rents are through the ceiling. So he failed to act on that promise. You had the whole issue delayed until the 15th again. So there's some real questions as to whether this progressive majority is going to hold together at all anyway. But there are issues that Glover has said, and Crone supports him in bringing up, And apparently Brown is also on board with this, although she wasn't at the meeting. This is sort of the skivvy. And what are those issues? Well, protection for RVs so that Chief Mills will, in fact, be directed to follow the law and lay off the vehicles who are there for less than 72 hours, maybe set up areas where they can park, maybe do something about Cynthia Matthews' atrocious anti-homeless no-parking-at-night zones that the city has set up in many places on the west side, along the beach and other places that have nothing to do with protecting the residential rights of residents, but have everything to do with pandering to the bigotry that says a person cannot park a vehicle at night because that's somehow a form of vehicle storage or some nonsense like that. RVs also need places to dump their stuff. People need support in that regard because RVs are a form of dealing with the housing crisis, a form of the homelessness crisis. If you get tired of seeing homeless people sleeping in the doorways of the downtown areas, or you're concerned that they're despoiling the environment in areas in the Poganip, then you damn well better make places for people or let them at least provide their own places in vehicles. That's, of course, a small minority of homeless folks have the resources to own and live in a vehicle, but even they are being mercilessly harassed and prosecuted as this incredibly evil gentrification process is taking place, this process which drives up the rents, encourages housing and real estate speculation, and essentially makes it unlivable not just for homeless people, not just for people in RVs, but for renters, because the rents become extraordinarily high. So anyway, that was one of the things discussed. We did not discuss any rent protections. I'm surprised. That was one of the issues we were supposed to talk about, but we did not. I understand that Cynthia Berger, the person concerned with, one of the many concerned with tenant protections, will be given this award at the ACLU later tonight, 7 o'clock on the 3rd, at the, I guess it's... Peace United Church is where they're holding their ACLU event. I can find that out, and I will try to clarify it, I hope, later in this broadcast. In any case, what issues were on the agenda that Monday, and will be on the agenda next Monday, that's tomorrow, actually, and hopefully on the actual City Council agenda, which is being made up this coming Wednesday, and will be for this Tuesday after next, Tuesday the 11th, the City Council meeting in February, the 12th. And other issues had to do with, of course, some protections for the Ross Camp and resources for the Ross Camp, which is, after all, where, as I said to Steve Plage, a significant plurality of homeless people are living, a significant number of homeless people are living. Don't get me wrong, there's a majority living elsewhere in different places, and there are many homeless people who don't want to go to the Ross Camp, they have said, in part because it is, A, so easy to get drugs there of a hard kind. It has a reputation as being a sort of a open-air drug market. Brent Adams has in no small part been responsible for spreading that story, which I think may well be true, although while it is... I haven't heard people who live there complaining that that is a reality that they are unable to live with. I'm sure that some would prefer that that not be the case. I haven't done a survey out there of that. But in any case, people out there need to live. They need a place to go. And people elsewhere throughout the city also need a place to go. Their plight was not really taken up, except in terms of ordinance changes. I'm working with Micah Posner and others to propose ordinance changes and also access to bathrooms. That was another issue. As you may know, Conscience in Action and Huff have been concerned with the shutting down of public bathroom facilities at the Loudoun Nelson and at the City Hall, and the inadequate facilities at night where there are no 24-hour bathrooms, only 3 24-hour porta-potties. I guess what with the Ross porta-potties, there are now, they've doubled the number of porta-potties citywide, but you have to go out to Ross to take a shit. I mean, it's, I checked the bathrooms, or the, I should say, the porta-potties out on Monday, and it was a mixed bag. Some were clean, some weren't, but there were certainly more in any one spot than I'd seen provided for poor and homeless people who have no options, rather than simply lined up to give some temporary relief to construction workers who are assisting in the great gentrification project of Cynthia Matthews, Terrazas, and all the other council members who are pushing that particular city bent, which is bent on essentially removing a lot of the community I know and love from this town. So all these issues are supposedly going to make their way into staff reports, where the staff in this case is going to be city council members themselves and their interns who are putting together these reports, not waiting for the city manager, Martine Bernal's staff, which have sabotaged 24-hour bathrooms in the past, even under such conservative pressure as Pamela Comstock, who tried to open a 24-hour bathroom, or two of them, in citywide in the parking garages. I mean, they already existed, didn't have to build any, just had to staff them. She got one open for 6 months after the staff continued to sabotage and delay it. But eventually they closed it, claiming that it wasn't clear whether the claim was vandalism or some woman who kept insisting on camping in there because she had no place to go sleep or because she felt unsafe elsewhere. Spurious reasons, in my view, that the staff like to use to maintain the ongoing drive-them-all-out-of-town mentality or pandering to that mentality, whether they actually share it or not. In any case, at the Wednesday Conscience in Action and Huff meetings, Huff members and a few Conscience in Action folks got together to sort of share latest updates, people delivering supplies to the Ross campground, the rumor that Parks and Rec staff was looking for additional overflow for the Ross camp, which is completely packed to the gills, or at least looks that way to me. I mean, there's still new people coming in. At least there were when I came there almost a week ago, wandered on through. But one of the considerations here is that Chief Mills and Tony Elliott's Parks and Rec Rangers seem to be driving people to the campground in response perhaps to neighborhood complaints or just as a matter of policy or maybe because they want to, I don't know, pander to the tourists. Who knows what the exact motivation is? We don't have a lot of documentation on the nature of the so-called complaints or the bases for which we should have a record every time a cop contacts someone and directs them to move. That should be a requirement for all police officers to make a note of that and that record be publicly filed, because that's a very serious thing when an armed gunman comes up and tells you to move along if you're not doing anything illegal. And given the Martin versus Boise court decision, the federal court decision that says you can't enforce sleeping bans or so-called disorderly conduct nonsense, where that's what camping bans really are. They're called disorderly conduct or public nuisance. If you have no legal place for the people to be, and since Santa Cruz never has had a legal place for the overwhelming majority of homeless people to be, and certainly doesn't have it this winter, then Mills and Elliott and the city attorney, poor Tony Condotti, are faced with a situation that if they start enforcing these laws in any documented way, and some attorneys either acquire some cojones or at least some financial savvy, and they want to get on board, they can get their asses sued off. That is, say, Condotti and the city and the police chief and those authorities that are engaging in these criminal violations of basic human rights will have to pay for them in money as well as in public shame, although I think these people are pretty shameless. I don't think they don't really care much about that. But in any case, what police are doing is they're driving people to the Ross camp. That is, not that they're picking them up and taking them there in their limousine squad cars, or in their Bearcat armed personnel carriers. No. What they're doing is they are demanding they go there, threatening them to, with different things, saying that you can't be here, you have to go there. And so people are being driven into these unhealthy, cramped quarters. And I say unhealthy not so much because of the drug use, although that's a consideration for people trying to get clean, or also people concerned about their stuff being stolen, because when people are addicted. They need to get funding, and there doesn't seem to be too many jobs and too much opportunity for people who are homeless at all, much less people who are homeless and have addiction problems without any kind of housing. It's ridiculous. It's not necessarily a safe place for your possessions, although if you have someone with you and they can stay in the tent to mind your stuff, and there does seem to be, to some extent, some kind of cooperation happening, it's better than leaving it behind a bush, or it can be. I guess some people would dispute that with me. I don't know. In any case, what Huff members decided to do, under my prompting, I have to admit, I proposed it, they agreed to it, was to do a kind of a reprise, a second edition, a second chapter, a second act, if you will, of our, I thought, relatively successful press conference with Chief Mills some weeks ago, when Alicia Kuhl and other RV owners, dwellers, invited Mills to come and describe what his policies were and to open them up to criticism and to try to express their concerns that the police and rangers stop harassing their vehicles when they have no place to go and when they're in behaving in a lawful manner. And, of course, Mills claimed they were doing no such thing, and they praised Joe Habe, the enforcement officer, and so forth and so on. You can view that whole thing on the videos that were taken. If you go to the YouTube, John Doe 13K, those are the key words. You go to YouTube, then you put in two words, John, and then Doe 13K as one word, and you'll find the video among Wes White's videos. He does a lot of homeless videos from his vantage point, and Salinas comes over here frequently to do those kinds of videos. He's part of the statewide union of the homeless, and we hope to get an interview with Tony Prince one of these days, the attorney who's covering that and kind of working with the Poor People's Campaign as well nationwide, try to link up around this issue. I don't know how successful that is. But in any case, the plan is on Valentine's Day, on the 14th, Thursday at 1:30, we'll again be appearing at the police department, hopefully with Chief Mills again, though it's up to him whether he wants to show up or not. Maybe have a few other activists, inviting a number of them and hoping they'll show, to discuss the kind of even more essential issue than RVs, since RVs concerns and people in cars are a minority of homeless folks in terms of the those who have that kind of lodging, but just the right to be freed from the danger of tickets and citations, not just camping ban and sleeping ban tickets and citations, but citations for being in a closed area, which means a park at night, trespassing on public property, which means, I don't know, being in the metro at the wrong time because they don't want you there. And they decided you aren't about to use a bus quick enough, or maybe you're talking to some of the people there and you're not planning to use a bus at all. You're just using the public space that your taxpayer dollars pay for. Yes, you pay sales tax, taxpayer dollars. Sorry for all you Take Back Santa Cruz types who claim that that's not something homeless people do pay for. They do. So it's important that not just sleeping and camping tickets be removed, and actually people should be getting some kind of restitution for the property that's been stolen by police and parks and rec rangers, by the time and liberty that's been taken away by the property, as I've said, that's been taken, but also that mainly that this not happen again, and that other ordinances that are being used instead, as I say, such as the trespass ordinance, such as the being in a closed area ordinance, and also the attached stay-away ordinances, which were created as part of the public hysteria generated by the bigots on city council who set up the Public Safety Task Force, or Public Hysteria Task Farce, as I called it, back in 2013, using fudged statistics from Steve Clark, the then deputy chief, who pointed out how much a credible amount of police time was being taken up with all these homeless people in the Poganip because he was running in there and giving them sleeping tickets or smoking tickets or being in a closed area tickets. Is there a great crime wave because they're engaging in what's called survival behavior, misdemeanors that involve survival, and that's what we're going to be talking about at this press conference, demanding that the police department and Parks and Rec stop this kind of activity and hopefully maybe even invite foreign observers to come and discuss this. I haven't really thought this through very carefully, and I don't know if anything will come of it, but the UN rapporteur on housing, I think it was, did show up, or maybe it was on human rights, did show up in Berkeley to examine how homeless people were being treated and mistreated in Berkeley and held a press conference there. I actually attended it, audioed it, and played some of it on the station some months back. So that's a possibility that may happen, but certainly what's going to happen is we are going to invite city council members to come. We're going to invite the heads of different departments to come. We're going to invite homeless people who have been victimized by this kind of ticketing, which goes on endlessly still. Although they're giving out very few camping ban and sleeping ban tickets, they're giving out plenty of trespass in a public area tickets in spite of the false claims. Yes, Andy Mills' false claims that they're not giving out those tickets. If you look at the records of the tickets they're giving out, then either Andy has just not noticed that what his police force is doing, or he's lying about it. You know, one of the two. I don't know which it is, but in any case, it's got to be stopped. That's the point of these kinds of protests and demonstrations. Everyone's invited to come. I'll be talking about it more as we get closer to the date. And now, having filled your ears with this stuff, I'm going to take a break and give you a little music.
Ladies and gentlemen, the President of the United States.
Fellow Americans.
He's been sick. And I think his wife is going to bring him some chicken soup. It's hard to defend an unpopular policy every once in a while. And there's this guy from the CIA, and he's creeping around Laurel Canyon.
My little girl, she waits for me. She's as plastic as she can be. She paints her face with plastic glue and wrecks her hair with some shampoo.
Plastic people, oh baby, now you're such a drag.
I don't know, sometimes I just get tired of you, honey. It's that's your hairspray or something. I hear the sound of marching feet down Sunset Boulevard to Crescent Heights, and there at Pandora's Box, we are confronted with a vast quantity of plastic people.
Take a day and walk around. Watch the Nazis run your town. Then go home and check yourself. You think we're singing about someone else?
But you're plastic people. Oh, baby, now you're such a drag.
Me seeing neon,
apples. I'm into that neck of
the woods. No, a prune is not a vegetable. Cabbage is a vegetable. Makes no sense.
And that was Frank Zappa, Plastic People. Never heard that one before, and I don't know if I'm ever going to listen to it again, but you got to hear it here. I suppose I should give a little update myself on what I'm doing, what I'm working on with respect to this upcoming city council agenda for changes around Ross Camp, RVs, the anti-homeless ordinances, and the Loudon Nelson and other bathrooms. I think there's going to be a change proposed that has to do with making sure that Parks and Rec can't close these bathrooms again without some kind of public involvement and public process, because that was one of the concerns we had, that Isbeth Ray, or Izeth Ray, I can never get her name right, the queen of the Loudon Nelson Center, the main manager, under Carol Skurich, who really actually bears the ultimate responsibility for this, shut down way back in March the bathrooms to the public after the San Lorenzo Benchlands campground was closed and this tiny, relatively small, barbed wire boneyard campground was set up on River Street for a fraction of those people who had been at San Lorenzo. Some of them migrated to Laurel Park and the Loudon Nelson Community Center area and slept there during the night outside in the park, as you might expect people do when they have no place to go. Tried to use bathrooms in the morning, and I think that might have been one of the prime motivations that had Izeth Ray and her squad of cleaner-uppers upset that rather than put in a porta-potty and deal with the situation as it happened, they just decided they'd lock down the bathrooms, demonize the homeless folks who were trying to use it, and essentially create only the privileged class, a new set of rules, could use the bathrooms, and a whole set of other sort of policies. You can't even be there for more than 15 minutes unless you're attending an event. This is what David Rovics got caught up in when he was doing an event there for Food Not Bombs. He was told he had to leave because he was not attending an event. He was essentially setting up his own event, or he was waiting for his own event to happen or to for that time to come up. He was there in the afternoon an hour or two before his event started. He wrote a song about that, which I played on Free Radio a couple times, about if you go to Santa Cruz, be ready for some pretty nasty shit that comes down. And it's something that it really flies against the mythology of the town, the progressive mythology of the town. And it will be interesting to see if this city council takes real action. Now, it looks like Glover is at least putting in some preliminary action to put some items on the agenda. The question then arises, when these items are not passed, if that's the case, will he continue to take action in other ways to make sure that he leads the community in changing these matters, even if he can't do it through a city council majority, or he finds a recalcitrant staff unwilling to carry out the orders of the city council, which has been the case at different points in the past on some issues. Obviously, one of the things they can do is fire city manager Martine Burnell. It's by the end of February, 2 months will have passed, and it'll be legal under the city charter to fire the city manager with 4 votes of the city council. Of course, that will no doubt enrage some, but it'll probably please a lot of others, both on the right and on the left. It's not that Martine Burnell is a bad guy, although I don't really know him personally that well anymore. I used to be on friendlier terms with him when he was the assistant city manager, but I think he's been kind of, as I say, happens to most folks, been eaten up by the very system that he rose to the top of. That's the most, I think that's the most expensive position. Maybe the fire chief is a little more pays a little more than the city manager. I'm not sure. But I'm afraid I'm wandering away from what I said I was going to mention, which was that my work is just kind of advise the concerns I have about laws that need changing or police practices. And the three areas I'm working on are those areas that we're going to be focusing on in this February 14th, Valentine's Day. Have a heart, let the homeless survive, or don't make survival a crime. I'll find the right phrase one of these shows, and you'll probably see it on a flyer. But the main laws that have to be immediately dumped are the stay-away orders law that lets police officers themselves, at their own initiative, and rangers, cook up, essentially issue a decree that a person can't be in a park where they were given an infraction ticket, say, for smoking or, I don't know, sleeping at night or sitting on the wrong side of a wall. That's been done at City Hall with people. Not the wrong side of a wall, sitting on a wall at all. You know, they call that conduct on public property. It's a nice way of getting people who are in a group to disperse that you don't want there. That's what Parks and Rec rangers tried to do to us when we were getting together for a protest against Carol Skurich's Parks and Rec department before Tony Elliott took over, in order to urge her to reopen the bathroom so that people who are disabled could go use the bathroom, elderly people could use it, homeless people, general citizens. But no, she wouldn't do it, and she wouldn't order it to be done. But she trotted out this myth of vandalism, which the public records simply do not substantiate in terms of any significant repeated vandalism there. It just is not there, and in terms of producing any real costs. So one of the things I'm going to try to do is get the city council to pass a measure that requires the staff to clarify all the costs of enforcing the sleeping ban, the stay-away order ban, actually the stay-away order provision, the can't sleep in the parks at night, he can't be in a closed area at night, the no trespassing ordinances that have to do with public property. I'm not talking about people having a right to have others stay away from their private property. And how much this is actually costing the city, and whether it disproportionately impacts homeless people. We found through past analysis of staff records, of police department records, when we finally got a hold of them, that it was used almost entirely against homeless people. If that's the case, it's really just an alternate way of driving them away, and so violates the same basic principles that seem to underlie the court's thinking on the Boise versus Martin decision that it handed down last September. So that's going to be a significant issue coming up. But now for a complete change of pace, I'm going to play a little something that I ran into. A thing called Debunking a Century of War Lies, on a website called the Corbett Report. I found it interesting, what I saw of it. It's a video, but it has an audio section that is quite interesting, and I'm going to play that now.
If, as the old adage has it, the first casualty of war is the truth, then it follows that the first battle of any war is won by lies. Lies have always been used to sell war to a public that would otherwise be leery about sending their sons off to fight and die on foreign soil. In times long past, this was easy enough to accomplish. A proclamation by a king or queen was enough to set the machinery of war in motion. But in the modern age of democracy and volunteer armies, a pretense for war is required to rally the nation around the flag and motivate the public to fight. That is why every major conflict is now accompanied by its own particular bodyguard of lies. From false flag attacks to dehumanization of the enemy, here are all the examples you'll need to debunk a century of war lies. This is the Corbett Report. In 1915, the RMS Lusitania, a British ocean liner en route from New York to Liverpool, was sunk by a German U-boat 11 miles off the coast of Ireland. The ship's sinking, which resulted in the death of 128 of the 139 Americans aboard, became a symbol of German evil and helped psychologically prepare the U.S. public for their country's eventual entry into World War I. But every facet of the story of the Lusitania, as it has been presented to the public, was a deliberate lie or a lie by omission. The boat was not a purely civilian vessel, carrying 3,813 40-pound unrefrigerated containers of cheese and 696 containers of butter, as the official manifest held, but gun cotton, in keeping with the shipment's stated destination, the Royal Navy's weapons testing establishment. It was not sunk by the German torpedo boat, but by secondary explosions from the munitions the ship was illegally carrying. It was not the victim of a cowardly German surprise attack. The German embassy placed a warning notice about the Lusitania in 50 American newspapers right next to Cunard's own listings. And the American ambassador to England at the time, Walter Hines Page, wrote to his son 5 days before the ship was sunk, asking, "If a British liner full of American passengers be blown up, what will Uncle Sam do? That's what's going to happen." So what did the official cover-up of the incident conclude? That the dastardly Germans had waged a perfidious sneak attack on an innocent peace boat, of course. And the rest, as they say, is history. A little over 2 decades later, America's entry into World War II came when the Japanese attacked Pearl Harbor in December 1941, killing over 2,400 American servicemen and civilians. But far from an unprovoked sneak attack, as the official government-approved history would have you believe, Pearl Harbor is best understood as a conspiracy to motivate the American public for war by first provoking and then allowing a Japanese strike on American targets. This is not even a controversial idea. It was commonly understood and discussed by many in the Roosevelt administration at the time. Henry Stimson, the U.S. Secretary of War, noted in his diary that just the week before the attack, President Roosevelt had told him, "We were likely to be attacked perhaps as soon as next Monday," and then solicited Stimson's advice on how we should maneuver them, the Japanese, into the position of firing the first shot without allowing too much danger to ourselves. Around the same time, Roosevelt sent a message to all military commanders stating that the United States desires that Japan commit the first overt act. So how did FDR and his administration provoke the Japanese into attacking? In late 1940, Roosevelt ordered the United States fleet to be relocated from San Pedro to Pearl Harbor. The order incensed Admiral James Richardson, commander-in-chief of the U.S. fleet, who complained bitterly to FDR about the nonsensical decision. It left the fleet open to attack from every direction, it created a 2,000-mile-long supply chain that was vulnerable to disruption, and it packed the ships in together at Pearl Harbor, where they would be sitting ducks in the event of a bombing or torpedo raid. FDR, unable to counter these objections, went ahead with the plan and relieved Richardson of his command. Then, in June 1941, Secretary of the Interior Harold Ickes wrote a memo advising FDR to embargo Japanese oil in order to goad them into war. There might develop from the embargoing of oil to Japan such a situation as would make it not only possible, but easy to get into this war in an effective way. Roosevelt followed 3 weeks later with an order seizing Japanese assets in America and effectively preventing Japan from purchasing much-needed American oil, which at that time accounted for 4/5 of Japanese oil imports. The provocations had their intended effect, and the Americans listened in on Japanese war preparations via radio. They received warnings of an imminent attack from diplomatic officials and military attachés. The attack was even predicted by the Honolulu Advertiser days before it happened. But all of these warnings were ignored. Even today, nearly 80 years after the events, new documents and memos continue to be found showing more warnings that Roosevelt and his administration deliberately ignored in the run-up to the attack. FDR got his wish. The Japanese attack was successful. 2,400 Americans died, and the nation, outraged, responded by rallying around the flag and jumping enthusiastically into war. But the Japanese themselves were no innocents when it came to lying their way into war. 10 years before Pearl Harbor, in 1931, Japan was looking for a pretext to invade Manchuria. On September 18th of that year, a lieutenant in the Imperial Japanese Army detonated a small amount of TNT along a Japanese-owned railway in the Manchurian city of Mukden. The act was blamed on Chinese dissidents and used to justify the invasion and occupation of Manchuria. When the lie was later exposed, Japan was diplomatically shunned and forced to withdraw from the League of Nations. The League of Nations fell apart precisely for its inability to prevent World War II. Its successor organization, the United Nations, engaged in its own war lies shortly after its creation to ensure that it would not meet the same fate. The Korean War, waged under the UN flag and sold to the public as a virtuous mission to save the South from the North's communist aggression, was on its face a war that should never have happened. The division of Korea into North and South was not the organic decision of the Korean people, but a plan that originated in an article in 1944 in Foreign Affairs, the Journal of the Council on Foreign Relations, which suggested dividing the country up and putting its administration in the hands of the Allies, including the Soviets. When the newly founded UN put that plan into action in 1945, Korea was arbitrarily divided along the 38th parallel, with the US administering the South and the Soviet Union administering the North. Neither was the war itself the organic result of decisions taken by the Korean people. In 1949, Owen Lattimore, a member of the Carnegie and Rockefeller-funded Institute for Pacific Relations and an advisor to the State Department on East Asian issues, wrote, "The thing to do is let South Korea fall, but not to let it look as if we pushed it." In a speech at the National Press Club the following year, Secretary of State Dean Acheson placed Korea outside of the U.S.'s defense perimeter of the Pacific, stating that any attack that took place outside of that perimeter would have to be dealt with under the Charter of the United Nations. Taking this as a green light, the North Koreans, heavily fortified and equipped with Soviet military aid, invaded the South. The war began on June 27, 1950, when the UN Security Council passed a resolution calling for members to provide military assistance to restore international peace and security in the area. The Soviet Union, being a veto-wielding member of the Council, could have vetoed the resolution and prevented the UN from engaging in the war, but they abstained from the vote altogether. When General MacArthur, leading the UN forces, managed to repel the North right to the Chinese border, he was prevented from completing the mission by Truman, who would not authorize any operations north of the Soviet-held 38th parallel unless there was no chance of confrontation with either Chinese or Soviet forces. MacArthur, shocked by this development, wrote in a letter years later, "Such a limitation upon the utilization of available military force to repel an enemy attack has no precedent either in our own history or, so far as I know, in the history of the world. To me, it clearly foreshadowed the tragic situation which has since developed and left me with a sense of shock I had never before experienced in a long life crammed with explosive reactions and momentous hazards." In the end, the bloody Korean conflict ended not with a peace deal, but a ceasefire. Not with the reunification of the Korean Peninsula, but with the establishment of a demilitarized zone to keep them separated. Nearly 3 million civilians died during the fighting, and the country was torn to pieces, all in the name of a military action under the UN flag that should never have escalated into war in the first place. In August of 1964, President Johnson was preoccupied in finding an excuse to justify a formal escalation of American military involvement in Vietnam. That excuse came on August 2nd when the USS Maddox, a destroyer supposedly on a peaceful mission in international waters, reported a surprise attack from North Vietnamese torpedo boats in the Gulf of Tonkin. Just 2 days later, it reported another attack. Johnson responded by launching retaliatory strikes and signing the Gulf of Tonkin Resolution, thus formally launching the Vietnam War. Years later, it was revealed that the story of the Maddox II had been a tissue of lies. The Maddox was not peacefully drifting near Vietnamese waters, minding its own business. It was part of a covert electronic warfare campaign assisting the South Vietnamese in launching attacks on the North. It had not been attacked out of the blue on August 2nd, as originally reported, but in fact had fired first. And, as even the NSA's own internal publication, made available to the public for the first time 40 years after the incident, concluded, the second attack on August 4th had never taken place at all. But these were mere details, and just like the facts about the Lusitania and Pearl Harbor, these details were suppressed long enough for the event to have its intended effect, rallying the public for war. The Six-Day War in 1967 between Israel and Egypt, Syria, and Jordan is yet another example of a war which was justified for reasons that were later exposed as lies. When Israel launched an attack on Egypt's airfields on the morning of June 5th, they initially claimed that it was a defensive strike and that Egypt had struck first. But this was an easily proven lie, and the claim was quickly dropped. Next, they claimed that the attack was preemptive self-defense, and that Egypt and its Arab allies had been preparing to strike Israel. But multiple Israeli officials, including Yitzhak Rabin, later admitted that Egypt had not been preparing a war, or even interested in one. And then, in the most outrageous incident of all, Israel attempted to get America involved in the war by attacking the USS Liberty, a U.S. technical research ship collecting electronic intelligence just outside Egypt's territorial waters at the time of the war. The attack, carried out by Israeli fighter jets and torpedo boats, was relentless. The Liberty was strafed and torpedoed repeatedly, with the crew sending distress messages and even hoisting a large American flag so there could be no doubt as to their identity. The Israeli attack was finally called off an hour and a half into the assault. Israel, caught in a blatant attempt to sink an American ship, offered an apology for mistaking the identity of the vessel. But it was no mistake. In 2007, the NSA declassified intercepts confirming that the Israelis knew they were attacking an American ship, not an Egyptian ship, as their cover story has maintained. Even mainstream historians now characterize Israel's attack on the Liberty as a daring ploy by Israel to fake an Egyptian attack on the American spy ship and thereby provide America with a reason to officially enter the war against Egypt. But the incident was soon memory-holed, and to this day, the Six-Day War is portrayed as an act of preemptive self-defense by the valiant Israelis against the dastardly Arab aggressors. By the 1990s, the post-Vietnam public was growing increasingly wary of calls for war in far-flung corners of the world in countries many had never heard of. And so it was that in 1990, when the politicians and their deep state controllers required the American public to be motivated to wage war against Iraq for its invasion of Kuwait, they hired a literal PR firm to sell an even more brazen set of lies to Joe Sixpack and Jane Soccermom. The most famous of these lies revolved around Nayira, a young Kuwaiti girl who sparked international headlines for her shocking testimony before the Congressional Human Rights Caucus in October 1990. In a tear-stained speech, she told a harrowing story of the horrors she witnessed being committed by Iraqi soldiers at a Kuwaiti hospital where she was volunteering.
The second week after invasion, I volunteered at the Al-Adan Hospital with 12 other women who wanted to help as well. I was the youngest volunteer. The other women were from 20 to 30 years old. While I was there, I saw the Iraqi soldiers come into the hospital with guns. They took the babies out of the incubators. Took the incubators and left the children to die on the cold floor.
It's difficult today to understand just how important this testimony was in setting the tone of the debate about whether America should commit military forces to defend Kuwait. It was reported breathlessly on the evening news, and it was repeated by President Bush on not one or two occasions, but six separate times in the lead-up to war.
Babies pulled from incubators and scattered like firewood across the floor.
And they had kids in incubators, and they were thrown out of the incubators so that Kuwait could be systematically dismantled.
Then, when the Gulf War resolution was making its way through the House, the incubator story was raised in Congress.
Now is the time to check the aggression of this ruthless dictator whose troops have bayoneted pregnant women and have ripped babies from their incubators in Kuwait.
And then again in the Senate. The vote passed, and combat operations formally began in January 1991. The only problem? Nayira was not some anonymous Kuwaiti girl, but, As a subsequent CBC investigation discovered, she was Naira al-Saba, daughter of Saud al-Saba, the Kuwaiti ambassador to the United States. Her testimony had been written for her by Hill & Knowlton, a PR company hired by the Kuwaiti government-supported AstroTurf organization, the Citizens for a Free Kuwait, to help sell the Gulf War. And the Congressional Human Rights Caucus that held the hearing where Naira gave her testimony? It was later found to be a Hill & Knowlton front itself. As everyone knows by now, the second Gulf War in 2003 was also built on lies. We all remember the lies about Saddam's WMDs and the way that story was sold to the public by Colin Powell at the UN. But this time, the media took the driver's seat in the campaign to sell the war to the public. The New York Times led the way with Judith Miller's now infamous reporting on the Iraqi WMD story, now known to have been based on false information from untrustworthy sources. But the rest of the media quickly fell into line, with the NBC Nightly News asking, what precise threat Iraq and its weapons of mass destruction pose to America? And Time debating whether Hussein was making a good-faith effort to disarm Iraq's weapons of mass destruction. Reports about chemical weapon stashes were reported on before they were confirmed, although headlines boldly asserted their existence as indisputable fact. And any media personality that showed skepticism about the claims being made, even wildly popular ones like Phil Donahue, host of MSNBC's then-highest-rated program, were summarily removed from the air.
Scott Ritter is here, and so is Ambassador Butler.
You had Scott Ritter, who former weapons inspector, who was saying that if we invade, it'll be a historic blunder.
Yes, now, but we didn't have Malone. He had to be there with someone else who supported the war. In other words, you couldn't have Scott Ritter alone. You could have Richard Pearl alone.
You could have the conservative.
You could have the supporters of the president alone. And they would say why this war is important. You couldn't have a dissenter alone. Our producers were instructed to feature two conservatives for every liberal.
You're kidding.
No, this is absolutely
instructed
true.
From above?
Yes.
We now know that, in fact, the stockpiles did not exist, and the administration premeditatedly lied the country into yet another war. But the most intense opposition the Bush administration ever received over this documented war crime was some polite correction on the Sunday political talk show circuit.
You and a few other critics are the only people I've heard use the phrase immediate threat. I didn't. The president didn't. And it's become kind of folklore that that's what's happened. The president went...
You're saying that nobody in the administration said that?
I can't speak for nobody and everybody in the administration and say nobody said that.
The vice president didn't say that?
Not, if you have any citations, I'd like to see them.
We have one here. It says, some have argued that the nuclear threat from Iraq is not imminent, that Saddam is at least 5 to 7 years away from having nuclear weapons. I would not be so certain.
Mm-hmm. And
close to imminent.
Well, I tried to be precise and I've tried to be accurate.
Terrorist state poses a greater or more immediate threat to the security mm-hmm. of our people and the stability of the world than the regime of Saddam Hussein in Iraq.
Mm-hmm.
The WMD story blew up in the neocons' face shortly after the war. But by that time, they had already succeeded in their plan to reshape the Middle East. But for the would-be controllers of public opinion, a valuable lesson was learned. Human rights and protecting the innocent is a more effective lie to sell to the public to motivate them for war. So when it came time to sell the war on Libya to the public, the UN-backed, NATO-led aggressors once again donned the cloak of human rights by turning to none other than the UN's Human Rights Council. The process that launched the intervention was begun by a coalition of 70 non-governmental organizations, which issued a joint letter urging the UN to suspend Libya from the Human Rights Council, and for the Security Council to invoke the so-called Responsibility to Protect principle in protecting the Libyan people from alleged atrocities being committed by the Libyan government. In a special session on the issue on February 25, 2011, the UN Human Rights Council adopted a resolution affirming the NGO's recommendations. The resolution was adopted without a vote. The Security Council immediately passed resolutions 1970 and 1973, authorizing the establishment of a no-fly zone on Libyan military aviation for the protection of civilians and the delivery of humanitarian assistance. 3 days later, using the resolution as its justification, the US, UK, and France began bombing the population of Libya. Meanwhile, the International Criminal Court's chief prosecutor, Luis Moreno Ocampo, began working on the legal basis for the invasion. He drafted the request for the court's judges to issue an arrest warrant for Gaddafi for crimes against humanity. Although NATO forces were already engaged in an invasion of the country on the basis of undocumented allegations by a group of NGOs, Moreno Ocampo's request was not issued until May 16th. On June 28th, the day after the judges agreed to issue the warrant, Moreno Ocampo participated in a press conference in which one reporter asked about the evidence that Gaddafi had ever engaged in the atrocities he was accused of.
I advise you to read the application of the prosecutor's office, many pages, I think it was 77 pages. We describe in detail the facts, most of it is public. And the judges also decided, analyzing the evidence. So, of course, we are prosecutors and judges, so we rely on facts. So we prove the crimes. That's what we did.
Although the document that Moreno Ocampo urges the public to read to understand the evidence of Gaddafi's crimes is indeed public, and is 77 pages long, the version made available to the public has been heavily redacted. In fact, of the 77 pages, 54 of them have been redacted, comprising the entire section of the document dealing with the evidence for the charges themselves. The most sickening part of this war lie is just how obvious it was. No one involved in this charade cared about the well-being of the Libyan people. Not the press, not the politicians, not the ICC prosecutors. And as a result, today, 7 years after the destruction of Libya at the hands of the United Nations-sanctioned NATO saviors, open-air slave markets are running in the country that the human rights crusaders once pretended to care about. False flags, provocateur conflicts, fake news and fake human rights crusades. Throughout the last century, a host of methods have been employed to keep the public playing the military-industrial complex's game. And over that century, the blood of untold millions has flowed as a direct result of these war lies. Truth is the first casualty of war, as they say. But if we desire peace, then we must confront the liars with our knowledge of these war lies. And armed with this truth, the public finally stands a chance of stopping the next war before the warmongers can conjure it into existence.
And that was the audio portion of Debunking a Century of War Lies by the Corbett Report. You can actually catch the videos, which are interesting to watch as well, if you go to YouTube. And here's a story, compliments of the Huffington Post from Black Voices. Portland police sergeant to precinct, if a homeless person is black, just shoot them. Sergeant Greg Lewis was fired last year for his comments, first released publicly this week. And this is dated 14 hours ago, February 1st. He is fighting the firing and may be able to retire with pension. Sergeant Greg Lewis was fired last year for reportedly making several racist comments to his precinct in Portland, Oregon. Lewis's comments were not publicly shared until this week when his termination letter was released by the Portland mayor's office. Lewis told about 20 other cops during a roll call meeting on February 12, 2017, that if they come across a black homeless person to, quote, just shoot them, according to many meeting participants who were quoted in the letter obtained by Oregon Life. Lewis made the remarks during a meeting with fellow officers in which he was leading a presentation about an officer's authority to handle an intoxicated citizen who was in a private parking garage. Multiple officers who were in the room reported Lewis the next day, and many of their accounts are cited in the termination letter. According to one account, the room went silent after Lewis's comment. There was some nervous laughter in the room, and another officer said, "Oh my God." Lewis reportedly laughed, threw his hands in the air, and said, "Fuck it, what do I care?" The reports made by several officers were all slightly different. One officer recalled Lewis saying, "Go out and shoot black people," while another remembered him saying the remark with slight variations, "If they're black and homeless, shoot them or kill them." Earlier in the presentation, Lewis reportedly told officers to be smart about whom they choose to detox in parking garages. If you come across a guy in a suit and tie that came downtown and had a little too much to drink, he's probably not the guy you want to detox straight out of the garage. He will most likely sue you, Lewis said, according to the account cited in his termination letter, which is dated January 12, 2018. If it's a homeless guy, you'll probably be safe. I doubt he's going to sue you. Lewis made the comments just days after an unarmed black teenager named Quinance Hayes was shot and killed in Portland by fellow police officer Andrew Hurst. Police mistook Hayes for a suspect in an armed robbery, and Hurst shot him three times. Hurst told a grand jury that he saw Hayes had a gun, and he was protecting himself. It was later revealed that Hayes had a toy gun, which the cops only found after Hayes was shot dead. Sounds like Happy John dying in Santa Cruz. Hurst was cleared of any wrongdoing. In a response to the complaints against him, Lewis told investigators that he had a habit of sometimes being a little sarcastic, according to the letter, and he does not discriminate against people based on their race. He also apologized and admitted that he now realizes his comments are inappropriate. City Commissioner Joe Ann Hardesty released a statement Wednesday commenting on Lewis's remarks. This person sworn to protect us made clear that he views certain types of people expendable in our society. I thank his fellow officers for reporting this heinous comment and elevating it as a punishable offense, she said. What Mr. Lewis said makes my stomach turn. Lewis, who has been with the Portland Police since 1991 and briefly retired for a month in 2016, was fired in early February 2018, a year after his initial comments. His remarks are only being made public now because the police union filed a grievance that could possibly overturn Lewis's firing, discussion of which spurred the mayor to comply with an open records request. Since city officials believe there is a good chance Lewis's firing could be overturned, they have proposed a settlement that would give Lewis back pay of about $100,000 and consider him to be retired. Under this settlement, he would also receive pension throughout retirement. Commissioner Amanda Fritz said in a Wednesday council chambers meeting that she felt personally ill with the terms of the settlement, but her highest priority is to ensure Lewis never serves as a police officer again. The most important thing is to get rid of this person on the police force and to make absolutely certain he can never wear the police officer's uniform, never carry a Portland police gun, and never be out in our community. And this settlement is the only way we can make sure this happens, she said. I would think that's nonsense, but then again, I don't know Oregon law. Commissioner Chloe Udaly added in the same meeting, "None of us are happy with this outcome. This is an imperfect solution made within a flawed system. The city will vote on the settlement next Wednesday." And there's his termination letter, which is 12 pages long and in small print. But there may be another link which I can read. It's awfully small. Maybe I can zoom in here. I would comment that, and without reading this 12-page letter, if it's as described in the story, if you're going to fire someone for comments that they make, not only is there a civil liberties issue here involved, but there really is a deeper issue of why aren't you going to his actions on his patrols? Why aren't you examining the number of people he gave tickets to or the officers he trained to see how they are behaving and whether he isn't simply being used as kind of a scapegoat or a token firing to cover for a general racist policy in the Bureau itself? I mean, I have this problem with the Santa Cruz Police Department, where an officer Barnett, we were able to document, gave black people downtown infraction citations at a rate, I think it was either four or seven times the rate given to non-black people, considering their proportion in the population. And he was, I don't think he was fired, but he was transferred to some other duty. Maybe it was just in the normal course of events. But for a short time thereafter, the police department, which had not put on its summaries of infractions given to people who gave them, where they were given for what offense by what officer, the race was omitted from that until this focus we had on the police department and Officer Barnett's behavior in downtown Santa Cruz. After that period of time, I believe it was for a while, brief time, they actually did add to the police summaries of these citations the race category, because the race is part of their citation, their tickets that they fill out. The officer is supposed to check race as a part of when he writes down a citation for someone. However, soon afterward, they began ignoring that again. And when you looked for the summary and they sent you a summary of the citations, race was completely omitted and still continues to be omitted in Santa Cruz on their summaries. What have they got to hide? Why aren't they putting race on these summaries? It's not that difficult to do. It's clearly an issue that's of concern throughout the country. I mean, Santa Cruz is a relatively small black population for sure, but there are concerns about racial discrimination here. Well, indicate that it's not show by showing the evidence, or else what's really going on? So what I'm going to conclude this current edition of Bathrop Spears Broadside with before we go into the flashback, which is twice or even longer than this actual broadcast you've listened to, is a segment of the Huff meeting that happened last Wednesday. Huff is Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom. It was a sort of a small gathering. Many of the folks had come for the earlier Conscience in Action meeting and then left after we discussed it, since Conscience in Action sort of has been taking the lead in inviting council members to come and raise the issues that they apparently, through Drew Glover's leadership, at least making like they're raising at the next city council meeting around Ross Camp, bathrooms, ordinances that criminalize homeless people, maybe even tenant action, who knows, although that wasn't, as I've mentioned, emphasized at all. But this is mainly a series of announcements that I made and some dialogue and discussion in response to questions, and I'm going to play a section of it here for you to hear, if you'd like.
That's the usual. We're only acting on complaint, which is sometimes true, but not really right. relevant but if the complaints are bullshit.
Exactly. So, and I hadn't taken it to that extent.
Yeah. So we're doing the Huff thing now. This is a meeting with Greg, Gloria, Coral's here. Haseen is on. It looks like Brian took off. So that will be coming up maybe at this new press conference that we have in a couple of weeks with him around the issues of Valentine's Day, have a heart, stop arresting for survival behavior, or whatever we're going to call it.
In Salinas, they were when I lived there, they were the one. The police were the ones that suggested going after people if they made false complaints. Good. And because they said, hey, Jerry, we know you'll go after them in a civil
case.
But we're also, it's also a criminal issue.
Right.
They didn't just say brush it off.
Well, then that's nice. They can say whatever they want, but then will they take a specific complaint from you that there is a false complaint that was made? And these cops here
in Santa Cruz, maybe not, don't
do that. And if you actually have tried to do it in Salinas and they've taken a complaint, did they?
I didn't try.
Well, then you don't know.
Right.
So that's the issue.
Right.
And the issue we're really discussing here are people who want to drive RVs away by falsely claiming they've been there for 72 hours. And we're asking police to say, look, don't file this complaint with us unless you're really sure it's true, because we have ways of knowing whether it's true or not. And if it isn't, we will recommend to the DA you be prosecuted for filing a false police complaint. So far, this has not been something Mills or his officers have been willing to do. And in the past, when I have tried to file a complaint against someone who is falsely complaining against me, so for instance, when the mayor, way back in 2014, Lynn Robinson, claimed I was disrupting a meeting because I put my tape recorder where I always put it, at the podium of the city hall, and she had created a new rule that said I couldn't do that. And when she had the police officer take it away and return it to me and say, you can't have it there, I simply went up and placed it again. When the officer confiscated it, I pulled out a second one and put it up there, and she had me arrested. My response to that was to ask the police officer, okay, I want to file a citizen's arrest against the mayor for filing a false police report. She claimed, and you were there, there was no disruption to the meeting. I did absolutely nothing but essentially put a recorder up there, which is something I have the right to do. I'm a journalist. I'm a broadcaster. I'm a member of the public. And even if I were none of these things, that action does not disrupt anything. The mayor disrupted her own meeting. But the police officer refused. That was Officer Bush. Now, I think Lieutenant Bush refused to take the complaint. He said he would make a report about it, but he would not take a formal complaint because that would have meant requiring the mayor to appear in court to justify herself for her false police report, which was a claim that I was violating the law by disrupting a public assembly. What she really wanted to do was have a pretext to remove me from the meeting. The district attorney never filed a charge against me for this, and it was completely bogus. But my point was, it's hard to get a police officer in our town, at least it was for me, and I suspect it is for others, to challenge, because of class prejudices mainly, a complaint made by someone else, however false it is, if it has to do with behavior that an authority is engaged in doing, or if it has to do with something that authorities like to support, which is removal of homeless people at the whim, behest, or suggestion of someone who's housed, which happens all the time, I'm afraid, or happens with some regularity.
They're big with their mouth, and they're big with their bluffing, and they're big with their bullying, but when it comes to actually doing something, you really have to check to see if that happens, in my view. Solidarity with the Berkeley activists defending People's Park against new attacks. I don't have a lot of new information on that, but people tend to be getting together there to help on that. I'm going up to Berkeley probably in a couple days to pick up the new Street Spirit. Trying to make sure at the next council meeting, which is kind of way down the road, that the progressive city council actually intervenes on behalf of people who are getting cut off by the mayor because she's decided to cut back time to 1 minute.
1.5 minutes.
Yeah, or 1.5,
one
right?
Minute.
Or 1 minute in some cases. According to a court decision, which I saw referenced some years ago in one of the stories I wrote in Indy Bay, and someone responded to it, they can cut it to 2 minutes, but they can't cut it any further because that's not a reasonable amount of time. Now, whether that's still an appropriate current precedent or not, I don't know. Whether it's precedent in our area, I don't know. But I was going to make a Brown Act complaint.
And I've still not done so. This has to do with Mayor Martine Watkins' disgraceful performance, cutting short the discussion on renter protections, and even on more broadly at oral communications, where we talk about any subject not on the agenda, in order to accommodate her decision to make nicey-nice with a bunch of Japanese sister city visitors who were waiting outside. She instead insisted that everyone else muzzle themselves and pretend they had nothing to say in order to pander to her PR display. Whatever reason she had for doing it, she was cutting off the right of public debate, and that's what I brought up here at the Huff meeting, and am hoping that City Council, other members, will take action on. At any time, the City Council majority, the four so-called progressives, could say, one could make a motion. No, we make a motion to overrule the mayor here. We want to hear 3 minutes worth of talk for each person. And if it goes over, they can stay till the end of the meeting and speak again or continue to speak. Or we'll just extend the time because the public is the paramount group here, not a bunch of visiting Japanese sister city people. you know, they're here on a junket. They're getting their expenses paid. They can wait another 10 or 15 minutes. Sorry. I don't expect Martine Watkins to do that. She's the mayor, and she, perhaps high on her own power or entrenched in her own sense of other mayors have done this, so I can do it, and public be damned. or it's just those, you know, those homeless people and those malcontents talking anyway. Or no one's going to complain, so why shouldn't I? Or I don't listen to these folks anyway, so who cares if I cut them off? Again, none of these things are things she would say publicly, I'm sure. Maybe not even think to herself. But I feel there's a lot of these items that I pointed out that actually motivate this. And, of course, she has no right to do any of this. But more important, the progressive majority who this public voted in is even more to blame for not intervening if it doesn't intervene. And that's what we have to demand they do.
To her claiming that in so doing she is disallowing the public from making required public comment if they wish to make it. She not only cut back the last few speakers to 1 minute, she also cut off the last speaker. Elliot was cut off when Elliot wanted to speak on during oral communication. And the time was not up. And also she kept making threats, oh, you're the last speaker, you're the last speaker.
Why did she cut him off? Did she have a reason?
No. No, she just, her reason was they had a Japanese delegation outside that wanted to come in.
For the
Sister City bullshit. And no, that's very nice. But the fact is, the public has the right to speak, and she has to extend the meeting if that's the case.
Yeah. Did the mayor delegate it to the clerk, who's the one that usually sets the time? And I haven't been to one of these meetings here, but I was at all.
No, the mayor, states at the beginning of the meeting, or, you know, oral communication will be at 7 o'clock. These are the rules. Mm-hmm. Everybody can have up to 2 minutes, except if I decide they can.
And do they have a beeper? A beep thing?
Yeah. And there's a little beeper, yeah, and all that sort of thing.
And do they reset that? I mean, so, or does the mayor then overtake the beep thing and just arbitrarily say?
No. She can, well, what she does is she hasn't, the beeper gets set based upon what she says is the time. Mm-hmm. But then when the minute is up, she immediately interrupts the person.
Thank you very much.
In the middle of their sentence or at the end of their sentence, but certainly not at the end of their paragraph.
Okay.
And tells them, you know, to move on. But the more important than that is she didn't allow this person to speak at all. She didn't allow Elliot to speak, and there was time remaining.
That's absurd.
So that's the basis of a complaint. Yeah. I got to have the motivation to do it, and I started it, but I haven't gotten any further with it.
That's
so more important than that is the issue of raising the issue from the audience. So if there are four members on that council who can vote against that and overrule the mayor on any occasion, and if they want to, they can. And if they're not doing it, then what are other blather they tell us about our committee meetings and how nice that Justin talks to you for 20 minutes. And Drew's got all these interns working away.
Right.
Very, very nice.
Right.
But when the push comes to shove, will they support the audience on live in the real situation and offend their fellow council members? And the answer is probably not. But we have to push them to do it anyway because in seeing that they don't do it, we realize the deficiencies of what's going on, and we look for changes that really mean a fundamental change in that whole situation.
Yeah.
Because anyone who gets in that position feels obliged to be nice to the people they're with for all kinds of reasons.
Right. Yeah.
One, they want to be socialized, sociable. Two, they want to form alliances, and they want to get votes on certain issues. Mm-hmm. And three, they're all...
feel good about themselves, just the simplest things.
Well, they also regard themselves as being in a position that's a higher platform than everybody else down there. They have been especially delegated because they've been elected in a so-called representative election, which has nothing to do with the real choice and the will of people. So, anyway, that was the thing I would have been brought up on the agenda about getting people, you know, speaking out at city council. Tenants in trouble, organizing with students, renters, elderly, disabled groups to establish mutual power and solidarity. That was a subject we could kind of talk about because Cynthia Berger has come and talked about those things with us. And that's a real issue because people are getting evicted. The rents are being raised. And nobody's keeping track of that I know of. Maybe some people are. There's not many people calling in on that issue. If they are getting evicted, Cynthia Berger is trying to handle it single-handedly, which she can't do. And everybody's waiting around for Justin Cummins to do something at the next meeting, because at the last meeting he voted down the rent freeze. You know, he voted to table the whole damn thing for 2 weeks, and so they got a majority, 4-3, maybe 5-2, to get rid of take it off the table for the time being. Next was Ross Camp Connections, contacts with the homeless on the edge, the ones you talked about, Greg, throughout Santa Cruz. We have done no further action in getting any connections out at Ross Camp. You know, we talk about it all the time, but we don't do anything about it. I think I've got a couple phone numbers, but I haven't. I need to call them back. And, you know, if I actually ever read my minutes or find minutes that have since disappeared here.
I think that now that people have seen some things that I said we were, you know, first I was kind of like trying to figure out what people wanted, as was Alicia, you know, and then they see those things happening. Now they realize, okay, it actually matters if they do join together. Before, it was, nobody would have. And I still don't know. I mean, trying to get anybody to show up for anything.
I'm just talking about getting phone contacts or email.
Alicia did.
Or email contacts.
Yeah.
I haven't gotten any contacts with anybody out there from her. At the
really? Because I remember her saying that she had several contacts.
She hasn't given any of those to me. Or she has.
Desiree.
She has,
but I don't know if she has the actual
I don't think I.
Number. I mean,
I have not been able to reach Desiree, or maybe I haven't tried.
There are problems charging.
I think I did, but, you know, they didn't. Anyway, so we need to get a whole we need a variety of contacts. I told you this 2 months ago when you first came.
It's just, I mean, the paranoia out there. Ago. I mean, just
right. And you lose your phone. There are all kinds of reasons, but that has to be done repeatedly in order to maintain connections. I mean, this just has to be done. It has to be a priority. But then so many things have to be priorities, like eating, sleeping, not losing your ID.
What has to be priority?
Connections with other people through phone numbers. In other words, if we're going to form some kind of group that responds to real issues, we have to know how to reach those people. They have to know how to reach us.
Yeah.
And there has to be a system of back and forth.
Yeah.
That's my opinion.
It's just like when people freak out. Anybody trying to do something good, even for the camp. I mean, they just.
I understand.
I mean, it's like I have to sit there with.
I understand, but it's not. It's
with a big knife, waiting for somebody to come tearing through the tent. Somebody freaking out.
Well, I don't mind having a meeting there. If people want to show up for a meeting there, that's fine. But it's not having a meeting there. It's having connections by phone with people who are there.
Yeah, but so, you have to know them first.
Well, I mean, I know, but Greg lives out there. That's the point.
Well,
you live nearby.
And I mean, every day it's I'm the teetering edge of being too goody two shoes and being kicked out myself.
Have
so many connections.
That's what.
Tough.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's
I'm
just
not
tough.
Saying I'm not
yeah.
saying it's easy
Slippery
to do.
Slow, so to speak.
Yeah, sure. It's hard to do, but that's what I think. It's one of the things you have to do. Then
there's the main priority.
Right, but I mean I agree. Organization. I mean I've been trying it and just trying to get anybody to.
Yeah, homeless lack of services. Homeless lack of services center update. Gotten complaints about their showers being out for the last 3 weeks. We got actually Drew to take action on that. He contacted Phil Kramer. Kramer said they'd have the boiler replaced within 10 days, which is another week and a half. But the point is they don't have they need to find an alternate place for people to shower in the meantime. And they're not. You know? So it's bullshit.
Right.
Bullshit. You know, and I got the runaround from the homeless lack of services center staff person that I called. I mean, she gave me some information, but she wouldn't say who she was. She wouldn't give me her boss's name or number. I was just looking for who was responsible for doing the shower stuff. And I guess Drew got further. He's a council member, and he took action on it that same morning. Good for him, in the sense that he contacted Phil Kramer, whose assurances he took. Kramer's executive director.
And there was a discrepancy between what you were told, how long it had been, and what Kramer said.
So the fact of the matter is, the real issue is, are people getting showers out at the Homeless Lack Service Center? And I have no idea, but I suspect they're not.
Right.
That's what I suspect is going on. And I would have brought that up here to see if we want to do something about it, such as go out there, and walk around going, we're all dirty and filthy, you want to give us, or bringing along a hose and hosing people, some kind of theatrical demonstration that actually
puts solar showers out there.
Puts pressure on them.
That was discussed, to have solar showers, anything but using the hot water that's available in the, what is it, the
Rebel Lee Family Shelter?
Yeah. See, that was. The Poly Loft is out of hot water, but the other places, they don't want
spillover to the families. They don't want the wrong sort of people going in there to alarm the people. Thank you very much. It's complete bullshit and bureaucratic.
And then there was talk about
ignoring the realities of what the people need.
Yeah, yeah, we're talking about shower trailer too. Yeah, that
well,
could be done.
There's a lot of talk about a lot.
Yeah, well, that may be looked into.
But they weren't. No, they don't want to put in a shower trailer that costs too much. It's $9,000.
That was discussed. That there was an alternative to that. There was another
camping shower.
Their alternative is to replace the boiler for $30,000.
Well, yeah.
And then they say, oh, we're having trouble with the contractor because blah, blah, blah. You know, if this were somebody on the west side, they wouldn't have any fucking problem replacing the shower in one day. But because 40 people are poor people and they're concerned, they won't do it. And for us to sit around and accept the crap that they won't do it is on us.
The Mid-County Homeless Coalition has a shower trailer.
That was Steve Plage making a comment. Yes, that's right.
And I speak very passionately about this, but to some extent, honestly, I'm ignorant. I think there may be some concerns. I think this says something about getting permits for the boiler or some such thing. It's just my feeling that if this were a more politically connected group of people, they would be getting immediate shower facilities at some nearby facility that would be opened up or paid to open up or some such thing. I'm going to leave it there because I kind of, I'll play a little bit more and then I'll leave it there and describe what's coming up in the flashback.
Hmm. Anyway, okay. So they're not doing anything. They're talking about it. That's the usual standard here. It's like we are. We're doing a lot of talking.
Yeah.
You know, we talk and talk.
Yeah.
SCPD, this is something else I was looking for years ago. We had a discussion of the surveillance devices in Santa Cruz, where they are, if they're being taxpayer-funded, are the records being kept, who makes the decisions, how much do they cost. I asked these questions, and I got complete stonewall. I wanted Sandy Brown to ask these questions in an email. Brown wouldn't do it. And she wouldn't. Oh, I'm going to do it. I'm going to do it. And she never did it. I'm going to do it, she said for the fourth time. Didn't do it. In other words, we have people who are, for some reason, stalling on key issues which concern a democratic society. I like to know if I'm being surveilled. I like to know where the fucking cameras are. I'm not a criminal.
Could Drew's interns do that? The same thing you asked Sandy to do?
they could, but the important thing is to get a council member to do it, too. Which makes it really clear that the staff doesn't give a shit what the council thinks, and the community sees that, so that those people who are nervous about, well, we don't know if it's been proven, or let's wait and see, let's give Drew a chance, this sort of thing, realize that there is a whole process in place which subverts various important parts of the democratic process, which is the right not to have your privacy violated when you're in a public place by police who are keeping records on this sort of stuff, or don't clarify what happens to this video. Anyway, so that's another thing I would have brought up, and I would probably bring it up again to them. Restoration of services at MHCAN, we talked about that earlier. Plaich is doing diddly squat about that.
What kind of services are they
have? Oh, they can't have a food bank, you can't. A lot of money for a security guard, 50 people a day instead of the 100 to 200 that used to be going through
Who's
there.
Who's
Plaich? What?
Who's Plaich?
Plaich?
Plaich.
Steve
Plaich was the guy who was at the, I think he was there when you got there. He was at the, in the conference room.
Oh, he was near me.
Silver haired guy. He was one of the, he left fairly early.
Yep, right.
Yeah, you know, he was the man.
What's his position? What's his position?
He has a number of them. One is the executive director of MHCAN. Another is, he's on the board of the American Civil Liberties Union. He's on the board of, I think, of the Association of Faith Communities. He works with them a lot. He does a lot of good things.
Right.
But he is he's a politician, and that's what the story is. He's a politician. I'm no fan of politicians generally, as you may have gathered.
Yeah.
There's a state union of the homeless which had a Martin Luther King Day rally out at the homeless camps in Chico, Paradise, Marysville, and so-called Hollywood River Bottom Camp, which was not in Southern California, but up near Marysville, which was near Paradise, you know, the town that burned down. And a lot of people, including people who had houses, or, you know, were camped out in Kmart lots or wherever the hell they were, and they were cut off from services. They pulled the porta potties out. They told them all to leave. Yeah. And the homeless union went to different cities and kind of tried to encourage them to, I don't know what they were doing, actually. Wes White, I think, did video on it. I'm still waiting to see the video.
Don't forget that Anthony Prince is working on the lawsuit for...
And that Marysville homeless sued the police in Marysville and the various authorities for destroying all their property and bulldozing their camps, which, you know, is nothing new to any of us or any of them. But they... it was a sort of a handwritten, pathetic lawsuit. Longhand it was written on and so forth. But then Wes White got Anthony Prince, an attorney, to come in and help them with it. Now it's a serious lawsuit, and they're actually supposedly negotiating with the city about damages. The problem with these lawsuits is they may get some money, but it doesn't necessarily change any of their policies. They'll do it again the next day, to the next group. Then you got to wait 3 years,
right,
find an attorney,
yep,
sue them in court. I mean, it doesn't help if, you know, you got the government burglarizing your home and destroying all your property. This is bullshit.
Uh-huh.
Howdy.
Howdy.
Then finally, the last thing is that I got on this agenda, improving support between activist groups concerning new models for homeless self-determination and mutual aid, which is a kind of a fancy way of saying what... I think that's more about the elderly, the disabled, all these sorts of disadvantaged groups supposedly realizing that they're all getting screwed by a variety of things, ranging from rents, inflation, police, state stuff, meaningless work, I don't know, whatever, white skin privilege, patriarchy, you know, you got the whole thing if you want to get to it, all these different things that are active and functioning, but often invisible kinds of forces which people suffer under. And, you know, authoritarian guys giving long speeches to people, not letting them talk, things like that. So.
And there's more to that Huff meeting, and you can get more of that kind of rhetoric if you show up every Wednesday at 11 a.m. at the Sub Rosa Cafe at 703 Pacific. Right next to the bike church. But coming up next is an April 26, 2015 flashback to a Sunday show I did then involving the Cannabis Advocates Alliance successful referendum blocking the Board of Supervisors from seriously restricting marijuana cultivation in this county, although I think they're doing pretty much the same years later. You're going to get to hear Phoenix, who I call the Heavenly Harpist. You'll hear me going on about the SCPD and issues then. There's some Red Church interviews with Nancy E., Ray T., fight against the homeless parking ban on Fern, Limekiln, and Coral Street, the 24-hour parking ban that was being put in. An earlier Ross Camp report from 3 years ago, Hutch the Lone Wolf, a guy seized by five cops near Starbucks sidewalk, Sonny and his pooch, Mary Jane, dealing with a boardwalk bust by six cops, and the 62-year-old Joe Reyes, ticketed, and Pat Malo, who can be pretty boring, but also can be informative, and it's an interesting kind of combination dialogue because Steve Plaich joins him, so does call-in from Lighthouse Linda LeMaster, a longtime homeless activist, now largely retired, not entirely, who was once chair of the Homeless Issues Task Force and an activist as well, fighting for the rights of homeless people and still speaking out about them with passion. And finally, there's a tiny bit of an interview between sometime Free Radio Santa Cruz broadcaster John Malkin and author, speaker, nonviolent activist Chris Hedges, who some of you lefties may know from his speeches on RT.com and elsewhere on the internet. I think he's occasionally interviewed by Democracy Now!'s Amy Goodman. Anyway, all this is coming up now, so have fun. And if you have things to report or criticisms to make or interested in free radio yourself, give me a call at 423-4833. Again, 423-4833. Ask for Robert, and you'll eventually get me. And I'll be talking at you again on Thursday or on Wednesday if you get to the Huff meeting at 11 o'clock at the Sub Rosa. And, well, talk to you there, maybe.